Welcome to Good Health, Better World, where we bring experts together to discuss issues that shape the health and well-being of our communities. Good Health, Better World is sponsored by UPMC Health Plan. I'm your host, Dr. Ellen Beckjord, and in this season, we'll focus on behavioral health and the mind-body connection at every stage of life. Let's dive in. We're going to talk about building resilience through trauma-informed systems of care. And I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Lyndra Bills, Senior Medical Director for Community Care Behavioral Health Organization, as well as Dr. Kimberly Blair, a psychologist at Western Psychiatric Hospital and Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome to Good Health, Better World, Dr. Blair.
Thank you.
Welcome to Good Health, Better World, Dr. Bills.
Thank you, and I'm happy to be here.
And we're glad to have you. And just to open it up, we know that trauma and anxiety affect our mental health and that both increased during COVID-19. Can you talk about how to tell whether you're experiencing trauma or anxiety and ways these issues can affect daily life?
Sure. So in order for something to be significantly traumatic in terms of a stressor, you certainly have to have an event. You mentioned COVID-19, and certainly for many people, that has been very extremely stressful, and for some people, a traumatic stressor. So that's one thing, having the exposure to a significant event. And there are many different types that we face as a general human populace. And then there's the experiences part, which is how the person responds to what has happened. And not everybody responds in the same way to the same type of event. So that's also something that varies, and many factors contribute to how an individual responds, especially their past life, you know, experience, like how they grew up and things that they might have experienced growing up, but also their social support. So there are many types of things that could influence the type of experience or how somebody takes it in. And then the effect would be whether or not it then is something more significant or something that would contribute to the person having a hard time with their job or social interactions, things like that.
So do you think it's fair to say that, let's say the same event for two people, that the effect that event has is really mediated through that experience, and that experience gets moderated by lots of individual level factors, both current when the event is experienced and even in their history?
Yes, that's a really good way to think about it.
And so when we talk about the effect, could you say a little bit about the range or spectrum or continuum of effects? And words that we often use to describe these kinds of effects might be stress or anxiety or depression. Can you say a little bit about how those are different effects and whether it's useful to think about those effects on a continuum as we seek to understand the ways that people respond to traumatic events?
I like the way you phrased that question. So it can be a continuum. So the types of terms people use, so being really anxious and immediately reacting to an event. So being anxious, worried, feeling your heart race. There's a lot of physical reactions to severe stressors that people have very commonly. Heart racing is one thing, could be sweating. You could feel very tense. So those are all kind of immediate reactions. And then certainly a person can experience a lot of images, can have recurrent thoughts and or images or sensations of what the experience was about, what it felt like. And those things can pop up very unexpectedly. You might hear the term flashback, or some people have nightmares, and it can also be experienced in the body. But those things start coming up if the person is going to have a more severe impact from the event. And then the more that happens, the term we use for those are intrusive experiences, but the more that goes on, the more likely the person wants to avoid anything that could give them that sensation or remind them of what happened or make them feel that way again. And that is where a lot of the impact of traumatic experiences then leads to, you know, other more severe complications with their social functioning and working and things like that. Layered on top of that is the possibility also of having a depression or severe mood changes, and some people get very angry and are very irritable. And also people do things to try to give themselves relief. There's sometimes they might use substances. There's a wide array of kind of activities or actions that people take to get the relief that they really want.
There's some evidence that anxiety and even experiences of trauma increased during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Blair, can you talk about how to tell whether you're experiencing trauma or anxiety and the ways these issues can affect daily life? And given your practice focused on pediatrics, adolescents, happy to hear your thoughts on that population in particular.
So what we see happening with COVID and the pandemic is, you know, those children, adults, families that were already experiencing some predisposition to anxiety or depression, already having real challenges with mental health, those issues tended to become more significant. And then, you know, you see folks who may not have shown any sort of issues will then really come out with some anxiety and issues. And what we're finding, I run a clinic that serves children and adolescents and their families who have experienced trauma. And what we're finding, and this is an issue system-wide, nationwide, probably globally, is that there are a lot of folks coming in to seek out treatment, and the mental health system isn't ready to receive the volume. You know, if you are feeling that level of what we call arousal, which is just you're looking for danger and you're sort of used to living in that soup of just like things happening and the media talking about how many deaths are happening, all those things you're just stewing in for what's been years. And that sort of ramping up that what we call baseline of anxiety. And the higher that anxiety gets, the more it's going to impact your pretty much most of your functioning. One other impact that we in particular are seeing is that for children and adolescents who were home for a really extended period of time, school and, you know, community programs, those tend to be sort of the safe havens for kids who have a lot of bad stuff happening in their worlds. And what has happened is that they didn't have those people watching them and making those reports. So what we're now finding is this sort of uptick in children who've experienced a lot of abuse, neglect, those kinds of things too. So it really, the impact of the pandemic really is covering every part of the spectrum.
Dr. Blair, you characterized the COVID pandemic in a way that I thought was very interesting, was that it exposed the population and certainly children and adolescents to a kind of constant stream of information or communication about illness and death and dying. And so I'm curious if over the course of your career, if you think that population level exposure to trauma, particularly for children and adolescents, was increasing even before the COVID pandemic. I'm thinking about things like gun violence and mass shootings terribly often at schools. I'm thinking about the climate crisis and what kids are learning about with respect to the way our world is changing and ways that can be really scary. And not that any of those problems are new, but it seems like on all fronts, the sort of velocity or intensity of them has increased. Have you noticed changes in that over the course of your career and any tangible effects that you would say on either the folks who come to see you for help or ways that people who are exposed to trauma at an individual level are then doubly affected?
So there's a huge continuum, right? So we will see kids who, you know, have had all the breaks and really have been isolated to a certain degree by just the advantages that they inherently have, who, you know, they may not get exposed to community violence, but certainly school violence, that has certainly been something that we've watched and paid attention to before this happened. And if I were to pick out sort of a common theme looking across all of those children and all of those families, and this is just my experience as a clinician, I think that one of those things that is those feelings that kids and families may have is sort of that lack of control. So, you know, you have this pandemic or you have school violence or, you know, on kids who just sort of exposed to it in the media, to kids who've experienced it firsthand. And the common theme there being control is, you know, if we're going to, we don't want to try and empower kids to feel like they have some sort of control. So if you are able to provide specific ways to them that they can then take some sort of piece of control of their world, that will sometimes help sort of reduce some of those feelings of anxiety. And safety is one of those things that is sort of the first thing on the list when you're seeing a kid in treatment to work on their feeling of their sense of safety and their feeling of control and how they can help make themselves safe. So I think we can apply that to really all of those systemic stressors. And I think it's going to be different for different kids and what makes them feel better.
Can we talk for a moment about avoidance? And I'd like to talk about it as a segue into thinking about and discussing trauma-informed care, because so you're a psychiatrist and an internist by training. I'm a clinical psychologist by training. And I've often thought that avoidance is a really core construct that shows up in lots of psychopathology or lots of mental health or behavioral health challenge. What are the ways that healthcare delivery and the experience of receiving healthcare can challenge a person's intentions to avoid things that might trigger or remind them of a trauma?
Well, it's a really good thing you're kind of honing in on avoidance, because I would agree. I think that's one of the most significant challenges for the helpers, the clinicians, or, you know, in the healthcare area. If you are trying to provide some assistance to somebody who's had the impact of a significant traumatic stress, their skill set in avoiding or being tuned in to any kind of environmental cue or reaction from somebody that might touch on that for them, what was a horrible experience, is so important. I think healthcare providers and environments of healthcare need to be sensitive to how easy it is for somebody to be affected by the environment, in a sense, like in every possible way, from the minute you walk through the door, how somebody greets you, the way in which they greet you, is the environment of care, you know, does it feel comfortable? Does it feel safe? Those are a lot of things that healthcare settings can address and make better.
And then once they've got to engage with the system of care, it can raise issues that they may have been able to successfully avoid, so much so that it's really outside of their awareness.
Right. So it can make it so difficult for them to get, like, even basic usual care, preventive care, especially if you, you know, have somebody who's experienced difficulties in the care setting, or they might have been traumatized Some people are traumatized by medical care. And so the most important thing for care providers is being thoughtful to want to understand people's experiences.
Dr. Blair, I would love to hear your perspective on trauma-informed care, the importance of trauma-informed care, particularly for children and adolescents. And then as we discuss this, I'd love to hear your perspective on how trauma-informed care functions when you're intervening with a family.
So talking about trauma-informed systems, when we're talking about children and families, you know, one of the primary systems that they deal with throughout childhood is the school systems, right? So that education system is those are the kids that you see that have that armor on, right? That if you are constantly protecting yourself, looking for danger, those kinds of things, it doesn't leave a lot of extra bandwidth for them to focus on their letters and numbers and reading and science. And so they're missing a lot of those things. And so, you know, you do have to go in and sort of look at each system and see what the needs are in each. I think that with COVID, you have this sort of awareness that, like, really most kids right now have exposure to some sort of trauma, and it has affected them in individual ways. Some kids have had family members pass away. And some kids, it's like I said earlier, it's just a matter of, you know, that constant exposure to death and sickness, and that sort of staying with them. And I think a lot of those issues for kids we're going to see short term, but also, you know, what we're going to see long term for some of these is, I think it's, you know, even with a pandemic to stop tomorrow, and if we were able to, like, eradicate that illness and no one got sick anymore, we still have all of this time with all of this exposure to this stuff that's really going to stick with us. I think on a national level, there, at least some of the advocacy groups, some of the professional organizations are really paying attention to trauma and how it affects kids in the classroom, and how we have this sometimes competing agenda for trying to meet our educational goals for kids, to give them those skills that they're going to need to be successful. At the same time, dealing with all the stuff in that kid's world coming into the classroom. And, you know, we're certainly not where we need to be with regards to that, but there are there's funding that's starting to go to schools, some of it as a result of COVID and the pandemic, but it's that focus on trauma and that understanding that our kids are not just sort of empty vessels in the classroom for us to sort of put all this educational knowledge in. I think that most education systems recognize that there's more work to do. And so we really are beginning to I think focus more than we had before, but it had started prior to COVID. COVID just, I think, made things a little bit more urgent.
Dr. Bills, what are some of the ways that providers can take a systematic and evidence-based approach to assessing trauma history so that they can be informed in their efforts to deliver trauma-informed care?
Well, it is really important for all healthcare systems or places you get healthcare to certainly try to be trauma-informed and thoughtful, which would mean that you would want to do some type of screening or at least start with history taking. So there are, for instance, things like using the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey. So a lot of healthcare settings use that. A 10-item question to get a history of a person's early adversity or experiences that could have made it difficult for them ongoing or predisposed them to have problems with other stressors. So that's something you could do. And also, there are many clinical screening tools that are available and widely accepted And every healthcare setting should take a look at those available tools and kind of decide what would fit in terms of their process.
And so, Dr. Blair, you're really a specialist in the mental health field. Your specialty is trauma. What's your take on how well the healthcare system is doing at delivering trauma-informed healthcare? And is it not uncommon for kids and adolescents to present with physical symptoms that are really related to an underlying traumatic experience?
So I think we've known for a long time that those physical symptoms come along with anxiety. And certainly, you know, when we're talking about anxiety as a result of trauma, we see those as well. And, you know, with regards to my specialty, it is trauma. I came into the mental health field as an early childhood mental health specialist before early childhood mental health was like a thing. And so what I noticed over years of practice was that we were doing a pretty good job of addressing behaviors, and including things like, you know, somatic complaints, those physical health symptoms that go along with it, that everyone's experienced that tummy ache, you know, when you're anxious. But, you know, it became very clear to me that we were missing a piece because we were addressing behaviors, but we weren't necessarily diving deep into those events that happened that sort of caused some of those or led us to some of those behaviors. And so, you know, it evolved from there. We went back and then we started providing specific trauma treatment for young children. And we have grown from there. And I think that that's relevant in that when you're looking at the mental health system and the physical health system, not all needs are the same. And so one of the things that we recognize is that our specialty, quote unquote, really is for kids who've had many complicated sort of life-altering stressors and maybe over a long period of time, we call that complex trauma. But at this point, systemically, you have kids who experience different levels of trauma in every context, in every level of care for mental health, and in integrated care, in physical, you know, pediatrics practices do their screenings for anxiety and depression and those kinds of things. And you're seeing it everywhere. So one of the things that we've attempted to do is get information out to all of those different systems. What we're trying to do is getting that information out there from a very basic level that's applicable to everyone, but then going back and talking to the integrated care clinics about what they're seeing and helping them to sort of craft some processes and procedures if they need additional to be able to deal with the kids that they're coming into their doors every day. And it's not a one-size-fits-all type of setting.
Dr. Bills, it seems like there are ways that trauma-informed care can help to reduce barriers to receipt of good health care among people who have a trauma history, because trauma-informed care will be sensitive to and accommodating of their needs. Is it also true that trauma-informed care has value because recovery from trauma has any number of physical and mental health benefits in its own right?
It's definitely worth noting, but certainly ongoing stress and chronic traumatic stress can lead to a number of health problems and challenges that can really be difficult for folks. So it is true that building resilience, which is possible, some people are naturally more resilient or they have those skills, but you can always learn skills to become more resilient. And that's important for people to know, because sort of building up your muscle to handle the impact of stressors.
Resilience building is important. I'm glad that you mentioned that a history of one or more traumatic experiences is not determinant of some future state, that treatment is available, recovery is possible, resilience is achievable for lots of people. Would you also comment on what might even lie beyond that with respect to post-traumatic growth and what some of the circumstances are under which people can not only recover from trauma, but can use that experience as a way to achieve personal growth and really thrive in ways that are facilitated by their recovery from the traumatic event.
So I'm going to go back a little bit to what I was mentioning earlier related to like a trauma-informed approach. So I mentioned safety and emotion management. I think about post-traumatic growth as a transformative phase, basically. When people are able, they're interested, they are ready to take a look at those specific traumatic events or, you know, any, whether it's one or more than one, using evidence-based practices, which you mentioned. Going through that process is the kind of helps develop their ability to transform those experiences and really learn from those experiences. And that's, to me, what the post-traumatic growth is all about. You know, I've certainly treated a number of people, and I would say it doesn't ever totally go away, but the ability for a person to not have to have their every moment of every day driven by what happened to them is they're able to move past that. And that's a big deal.
Do you think that we talk enough about resilience and hope and recovery in our bigger conversation about trauma?
Well, the simple answer I have is no. I think we could do a lot better to talk about that. You know, it's not to diminish the impact of really very horrible experiences for some people and certainly the ongoing, very significant stressors in our world. But I do think, you know, as a health provider, it's my job to instill hope. It's my job to provide options and to brainstorm with somebody to help them find healing. And I do think that there are so many different ways that somebody can do that.
Dr. Blair, what does recovery from trauma look like in children and adolescents? One of the themes that seems to be emerging in the conversations that we're having this season on Good Health, Better World about behavioral health is that people recover from behavioral health and mental health challenges. Given your role as a direct care provider, what does recovery look like in children and adolescents who've experienced trauma?
I think that, you know, your ultimate goal is for children to be able to function in their world in a pro-social and for them to be happy. And it sounds very simplistic, but I have so many parents come in and tell me, I just want to have a happy, healthy kid. And that's your ultimate goal. Now, that can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And that's not to say, you know, once you work with a child to create their trauma story. And it's important to pay attention to that trauma and explain that trauma and process that trauma in a way that child is going to understand. So they, you know, the saying is sunshine is the best disinfectant. You know, that I think applies here. By not talking about it, you're not addressing it. So when we do address it, that's not to say that those experiences just don't go away. They're in there, they're going to stay in there, and it's not unusual for us to see a kid when they're younger and have the parents call us a few years later and say, you know, my child hit adolescence. You know, they're understanding in a different way what happened to them. And so you sometimes have to reprocess things over time. And so when you're looking at outcomes, you want to see them be able to interact with their world in a constructive, appropriate, healthy way.
The one question, Dr. Bills, if you could enact one change or push for one policy, what would it be to really have a transformational effect on either the availability of or the reliable receipt of trauma-informed care?
That's also a really great question. And one thing is tough, but I'll tell you what comes up every time I think about this. I would say real screening. If I'm thinking about the healthcare system, I'm going to say screening and meaningful screening. So if I was just going to pick one thing, and I'd have to say screening for the impact of traumatic stress. And I think all that, all the processes that have to go into place to make it done, you know, as best it can be done for the person to have a good experience and to for it to be meaningful, it requires really a system level shift. A lot of thought has to be put into what happens if the screen is positive, you know, what do we do?
Dr. Blair, I am wondering if, as you survey the landscape and think about things that you may feel hopeful or excited about in the field of trauma-informed care, pediatric and adolescent mental health, where are the most important leverage points? Is there a place or an intervention or a policy or a part of the system where you think if we really doubled down here, there would be pretty transformational returns?
So it's actually something I've thought about quite a bit. And I feel I have to mention that, you know, I feel very fortunate to work for UPMC and Western Psych. And I've found that, you know, outside of the box thinking is really important. And quite honestly, over my, goodness, 17 years there, I've felt that ability to sort of try different approaches and different ways to deliver care to children and families. I think that we've got a lot of good folks out there doing some really good care. I think they could always use more training and support. One of those things that sort of drove me early on was not wanting the clinicians who worked for me or with me to feel like they didn't know what to do. So, you know, seeking out additional supports like joining the National Child Traumatic Stress Network was a way to get them that additional training in those interventions that are effective. So, you know, that's one thing. But going back to the coming from the academic, we just don't have enough people. Like, I really wish that, you know, we would look at this the mental health shortage in a similar way to we looked at teacher shortages in the past and really invest a lot of support and large-scale funding to help encourage students, you know, undergrads to go on to get those degrees. And I think if I could have my wish list and what I would really like to see, I would like to see a big investment in higher education and training and the encouragement of you know, undergraduates and those who just starting their undergraduate careers to consider mental health professions.
That's a great idea and such an important leverage point within the broader system. Dr. Blair, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us on Good Health, Better World. It was wonderful to hear your perspective, particularly as it relates to children and adolescents in the context of trauma-informed care.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Bills, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, and I've enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Good Health, Better World, presented by UPMC Health Plan. Be sure to check the episode show notes for information and resources related to behavioral health. We hope you tune in next time for more support and insight.